Okay, all right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the final session of Marxism 2011 for Saturday, because there are more sessions on tomorrow. This session tonight is going to be Sean Harkin, who everyone should welcome. He's come all the way from the United States. From the International Socialist Organization over there. He's also a regular contributor to the International Socialist Review, which is their theoretical magazine, and he's also an activist in a variety of different movements. So we're going to have Sean speak for about half an hour or so, and then after that we will have time for questions, discussion, debate, anything people would like to do. So, all right.
Great. Do you want this? No? I don't know if I'll be able to go. Should I try and hold the mic? It may be a bit difficult to hold the mic, but does that sound okay?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. It's great to be here, comrades. It's been a fantastic conference. That's been really, really clear. I've learnt a ton of stuff, and I'm going to be able to take that back to our American comrades and share it. So I wanted to start off by saying May 1st this year is the 125th anniversary of May Day, which was an American tradition. The fight for the 8-hour day is inspired initially by the Australian 8-hour day struggle. And it's become a very important day of action in the United States. It's been revived, if comrades don't know, by the immigrant rights movement. Back in 2006, 5 or 6 million immigrant workers, their supporters and churches, activist groups, left groups, organized a boycott of work, which is really a strike of work. It was a day without an immigrant, and we shut down, industries across the United States. It was a very inspiring day. And thinking back about the 125th anniversary, August Spies was he was a German immigrant. Immigrants have played a really important role, consistently reviving the American labor movement or being at the vanguard of that. And August Spies back in 1886, before he was actually executed for a crime that he didn't commit, he said, there's a subterranean fire in the United States. He says, it's global, and I'm paraphrasing. He says, you can't put this flame out because everywhere it'll rise up again, only stronger and stronger and stronger. And I think over the last 125 years, it's certainly not been a straightforward advance for the American working class. There's been massive setbacks, but there's been periods of massive struggle as well. The 1930s being the high point of that, but the 1960s and 1970s, amazing periods of struggle as well, where large numbers of people drew revolutionary conclusions and really believed that the change of the world was possible and transformed American society as a result. I think that for us, as well as for other people around the world, we've been wondering, in the midst of the economic crisis, is the American working class capable of fighting back? And I think for us, and hopefully for people around the world, we've been inspired by the fight back in Wisconsin. And we didn't think that Wisconsin was going to be the place to kind of possibly see or become a reference point for a possible rebirth of the American working class movement. The point is, there's a subterranean fire burning in the United States. What's happened in Wisconsin is just an indication that it can erupt in the most unexpected ways. So we have many and massive challenges ahead of us in the U.S. But I think what we've learned because of Wisconsin and the struggles there is that what Howard Zinn said. He said it's not really about who's sitting in the White House. He says the most important thing is who's sitting in the streets, who's sitting in the workplaces, and who's sitting at the lunch counters. And that's the thing I think we have to take away from the inspiring struggle in Wisconsin, that American tradition of subterranean struggle is alive, alive and well. Yeah. Now, people are probably familiar with Scott Walker. He's become a household name now around the world. Exactly, brilliant. That was one of the signs as well in Wisconsin at the state capitol building. And I think I don't think that Walker expected the response that he got. He was extremely surprised, and I think he was caught on the back foot. as much as the American corporate media was as well, because their narrative about the American working class is that they're all Tea Party fanatics and that they don't support unions. So I think that they were caught off guard as well. But I also have to say that, I don't know if comrades are familiar with our journal, the International Socialist Review. Phil Gasper, who's a comrade living in Madison and was very involved in the Madison, Wisconsin struggles, has an article in the most recent ISR called "Can Revolution Happen in the United States?" And the whole article is about why won't anything happen here, not just not a revolution, but anything that looks like even a small rebellion. And Phil was saying, I wish Madison had have exploded just a week later so we could actually have had a completely different article. Because he'll have to have a response to his own article now in the next ISR. But he actually goes through, and this is what we've been grappling with, he goes through in this article just how bad it's been in a lot of ways, because he documents, I'm trying to look for these right now, the fact that strike levels in the United States are at their lowest in a very, very long time. And I'm not going to go through the statistics because there's too many of them. But strike levels in the US have went even lower as a result of the economic crisis, because people who have a job are mostly happy to have a job. If you've got 15% unemployment and scares about another recession, that has really had an impact, plus a very weak and timid trade union movement that hasn't been willing to lead the fight. So we were surprised as well. So that's just to say that you can't predict when struggle is going to erupt. I mean, Anand talked about this, and other comrades on the panel last night talked about, it seemed like the revolutions in the Middle East erupted from nowhere. But in the United States as well, we know where those struggles have actually come from, because we've been preparing for them now for the last 30 or 40 years. And the last 40 years, as we've talked about in the US, has been really just a one-sided class war. That's the best way to sum it up. We've had glimpses again and again of the capacity of our side to fight back. But it's really the fact that, living standards for the vast majority of American workers have been drastically eroded over the last 40 years. Most significantly, you can see that in the decline of the trade union movement from 35% of American workers at the end of the Second World War to now 6.9% in the private sector and 37% in the public sector, for a total of 11.9%. So that I think symbolizes the attack on the working class. And of course, that has meant lower wages, lower expectations. But it's also meant that there's been a tremendous amount of bitterness and anger that's built up, that doesn't often have a political outlet. Or, there's been examples of struggle where you actually get a sense, of the degree, of anger. So that's where Wisconsin has really flowed from. So it's not a surprise, and it didn't just erupt from anywhere. Obama's campaign in 20, Obama has just announced his 2012 campaign, but I want to step back and talk a bit about his 2007 campaign, Obama the candidate. Now, Obama tapped into this massive anger. That's really where all the hope gets generated from, and the optimism. That came from 30 years of decline in living standards and a sense that things have to begin to change. It can't go on any longer. And of course, the recession really sharpened all those class, it sharpened the class attack. It made things worse for the vast majority of people. So the expectations that were generated, Obama's campaign spoke to them and then developed them. He actually encouraged people to believe that things would change, that his election would actually, that we would have a government that, instead of attacking people and destroying people's lives, would be on the side of ordinary people. That's a good thing, I think. That there would be, healthcare would be a right instead of a privilege. He had a kind of national debate with John McCain, and John McCain made the mistake of saying, "I think it's a privilege." And I think Obama on that night won the election when he said it should be a right. So we, on all sorts of issues, Obama supported something that the trade union promoted that would allow for easier workplace organization. It was called the Employee Free Choice Act. So in every constituency in the United States, from Latinos, immigrants, African Americans, the labor movement, the LGBT struggle, Obama spoke to directly and put them in contact with the great struggles in the American past, you know, the struggle to end slavery, the trade union struggles of the 1930s. This is what Obama's campaign spoke to. And that's why there was such optimism. That's why young people flowed into Obama's campaign. Let me see here. Obama's just announced, that was Obama the candidate. Obama's just announced now his 2012 campaign. We've been told already that it's going to cost $1 billion. That's what Obama's going to raise to put this campaign forward. What he's going to campaign on, I have no idea. Probably just saying, I'm not Scott Walker. You know, don't vote for the lunatic right. But I think that, the right wing, as we know, tried to characterize Obama as a communist and a socialist. They were in desperate straits back in 2007 in the final hours of the campaign, and they really wanted to try and throw anything at Obama, and they called him a communist. And they highlighted the fact that Obama said we should redistribute wealth. And I think then that the right was surprised to find that a majority of Americans were becoming increasingly sympathetic to socialism and to communism. A majority of Americans said that they agreed with Obama's promise to redistribute wealth, which I think tells you a lot about, you know, America, what America was like in the 1980s in terms of, you know, the evil empire, the Cold War, how much America has transformed, how much American consciousness has been transformed because of the fact that inequality has just gotten so wide that it's actually opened people up to alternative ways of thinking about how we should organize the world. And of course, along with that, the fact that Wall Street detonated a world crisis that threatened to bring down capitalism has undermined the credibility, not just of neoliberalism, but of the free market. And we'll talk a bit more about that as well. So that was a surprise to the, I think also it was a wake-up call to us that something had shifted in the United States. Obama in office is completely different from Obama the candidate. I don't know how much we need to go through the list of betrayal after betrayal, but it's a shocking betrayal. And, you know, we were kind of talking about the fact that Obama, in a sense, was one of us. I mean, he was never quite one of us. He was a Harvard lawyer that ended up as a community activist in Chicago. But I know people in Chicago, labor organizers, Palestinian activists, that actually have Obama's number in their cell phone. They used to be able to get him on the phone to talk to him, to come to events like support for Palestine and so on. Obama in office is something, it has become completely different. Obama has done everything he can in both word and deed to show that he's no communist. And I think that he's made that really, really clear. So the list of betrayals, just to go through some of them. I think the first one is, wealth has not been redistributed in the United States. It's actually went in the opposite direction once again. Something like 1%, the top 1% in the United States now control something like 40 or 50% of the nation's wealth. The vast majority of people, because of the crisis and because of the inaction of the Democrats, have actually seen their lives get worse during the crisis. And the measures that Obama's pushed through, even the stimulus spending, have not really put a dent in inequality. You know, the banks got their $100 trillion bailout. They were happy and they moved on. There was no condition set on the bankers. That was a tremendous betrayal. The fake end of the Iraq war, I think that's been clear to the US population. Afghanistan, an expanded war into Pakistan, and now the bombing of Libya. So there's just on every issue, healthcare, the failure of the healthcare proposal, to actually rally Obama's supporters, allowing the Tea Party to kind of seize the debate around that. Now we have 50 million people without healthcare. So the social crisis and the crisis of inequality has got even deeper inside American society. And Obama, it's not just that he hasn't any solutions. He's actually pushed forward with a different set of rhetoric the needs of U.S. The new U.S. capital. So we have to ask the question: why did Obama do that? Why has it developed in this? And I was actually surprised because I thought, you know, if Obama wants to shore up his base, at least to win the next election, he's going to throw some decent or half-significant reforms in the direction of his massive base. How can you raise people's expectations this high and then deliver absolutely nothing? And that was something that Hillary Clinton actually warned Obama about during the election. She actually said this. This was a debate that was reported. She said, why are you raising people's expectations to do things that we are not going to deliver on? And so that just gives you an idea that, what the Democratic Party machine was actually thinking about, what Obama was helping to bring out of the box and to put in motion in terms of a set of expectations. So Wall Street backed Obama along with millions and millions of other people. Why did Wall Street back Obama? Well, Wall Street backed Obama because they knew that he was going to be required to save American capitalism because George Bush had done such a bad job and put America, in a hole in the ground, and that the U.S. empire was in such deep straits that it would need rebranding. And I think Cornel West, at the opening plenary of the Global Left Forum in the US, it was in New York there about a month ago, he opened it up by saying, Obama is the friendly face of US empire and he's no friend of ours, which I think is important. Cornel West is a leading African-American intellectual and activist, and there's been a real reluctance to kind of publicly state what is now very, very, very obvious, that there's been another betrayal for the vast majority of people. When Obama was actually in office, and the banks got their, bailout, none of the bankers went to jail. There was no conditions attached to the massive bailout. They then decided to oppose Obama and began to move their funding in a different direction. They then began to kind of help bankroll the Tea Party movement, and I'll get into that a little bit more. And then they began to put their money behind Republicans again, because the way that they looked at it, they wanted to put up any obstacle to any of the liberal initiatives that Obama actually said he supported as a way of undercutting and then disciplining the White House to force him back into their camp. I'm sure people here know that Rupert Murdoch was one of Obama's biggest backers. He said, it's amazing how enthusiastic, people are so disgusted with mainstream politics. It's amazing how enthusiastic everyone is because of what Obama's saying and putting forward. So that was another supporter of Obama. So we end up with a dynamic leading then into the 2010 midterm elections. And this election was presented in the media as a referendum on Obama's big government spending. It was a referendum on socialism. It was a referendum really on the American people. And of course, as we know, the Republicans did quite well in that election. They've taken back the House of Congress. They've taken a number of governorships and legislatures across the United States. And the headlines in the US was that Obama's election was a complete and utter fluke. That the American people have spoken, and they've spoken, in the words of the Tea Party, and they reject socialism and everything else. What had actually happened was that, the vast majority of Obama supporters were so demoralized, they stayed at home. They see no reason for campaigning and going out to support, a candidate who had actually attacked them rather than actually a candidate who hadn't stood up and fought when there was any obstacles presented in his way around any of the initiatives that he initially backed. So those were the headlines that we were presented with. At the same time, I mean, the right wing, as people know, had been moved into a complete and utter frenzy after Obama's election, galvanized by the fact that that there was a black man in office. That was bad enough for the right wing of the Republican Party. Socialism was now inevitable in the United States, and that they were the warriors and the real patriots that were going to stop this happening to the U.S. So the Tea Party, we were told, represented a grassroots rebellion against the American elites and socialism and big government. The Tea Party is no grassroots movement, and I'm going to explain now a bit about who the Tea Party is and who they're funded by. The first thing to know is the Tea Party is funded by Wall Street. It's coordinated by not outsiders to the Republican Party, but insiders to the Republican Party. And it's been manipulated by the Republican establishment, because if you think back to 2008, the Republican Party, the question was, is there going to be a civil war? Is the Republican Party going to survive this election? They were in such a deep crisis. So the establishment of the Republican Party has really used the right wing of the Republican Party to regain ground and to try and undercut, to set themselves up, to put themselves back, in power. Who funds the Tea Party? I mean, people have probably heard of David Koch. He is a co-owner. The Koch brothers are co-owners of one of the biggest privately owned corporations. They're billionaires. They are direct funders through the Americans for Prosperity. They've bankrolled a lot of the protests in the US. People might know Koch. Somebody pranked Scott Walker. If people heard about this, they called him up and he was idiotic enough to pick up the phone and have an hour-long conversation with an activist and said, yeah, we were thinking about putting some provocateurs into the Capitol building in order to undermine the protest, in order to beat up the protests and scandalous stuff like that. So that's who David Koch is. And again, it draws a direct connection between this is a man who opposes any kind of regulation of Wall Street. They make a lot of their money from, you know, manipulating the Wall Street and the stock market. So that's who one of the major backers of the Tea Party is. Hardly grassroots American people and low wage jobs. Dick Armey trying to remember the name of the institute that he runs. But Dick Armey was the House Speaker for the Republican Party. He's an insider Republican, and he's one of the people who's actually played a leading role in coordinating the political activities of the Tea Party as well. And Sarah Palin, as we know, I mean, she has egged on the Tea Party, but she joined the establishment in 2008 when she became John McCain's candidate. So that's some of the lineup of who the Tea Party are. The Tea Party were the enemy. They were the sworn enemy of the bailout. I mean, think back to like 2007, 2008. They were opposed to the bailout, completely opposed to it. That went straight to Wall Street. But then they actually, what does the Tea Party campaign for? Lower taxes and no regulation of Wall Street. So there's something that doesn't quite make sense if this is a grassroots rebellion. Why would a Tea Party movement that represents ordinary people who oppose the bailout now suddenly be out campaigning for the likes of David, for the Koch brothers? So who is in the Tea Party? Because that again is something that the American media has kind of blown up. And I would just say that like everything that the Tea Party has done has been vastly exaggerated for, I think, a domestic audience and an international audience as well. And they've been amplified, all their protests and activities have been amplified by Rupert Murdoch, Fox News, and Glenn Beck, because they've got a 24/7, entertainment, channel that you can see their activities on. And this has helped to galvanize the Tea Party and give them a sense that they're much bigger than they actually are. And then, of course, that feeds on itself, and it allows them to make themselves more important to different politicians that they're trying to influence. So their size and actual significance has been played up. Lots of studies have basically went through who the Tea Party are. If you want to read a kind of more detailed report, investigative journalism type, I would read Matt Taibbi. He writes fantastic stuff for the Rolling Stones, but he kind of followed them around for a while. And lots of studies have backed up that who is the Tea Party? Well, they happen to be white, suburban, vast majority white, of course, more suburban, less affected by the Great Recession, and conservative, meaning that these are not new people. These people constitute what has been the right-wing base of the Republican movement for many, many years, and they've just been mobilized and sent into a frenzy because of a whole set of really, really backward ideas. What motivates the Tea Party? Well, they are the Yahoo right-wing element in U.S. society. They do exist. I mean, there was an alliance between neoliberals in the United States and conservatives that was set up to undermine the social gains and of the social movements of the 1960s and 70s. So that alliance is still around. There's all manner of think tanks, the Heritage Foundation that tries to continue to push right-wing ideas. And that didn't evaporate because we had a historic election victory, the first black president in the United States. A lot of that is still there, and they've played a role continuing to push neoliberal and reactionary ideas. The things that galvanize them are, well, obviously there's the birther contingent, that Obama is not born in, the United States, and they chased that one. There's the other argument that America is being invaded consciously by Mexicans, and that this is the, you know, the next wave of the war. And there's just, you know, fantasy after fantasy. There are real issues within this movement. It's a sad fact, but like, yes, there's a section of the American population that has extremely backward ideas. That's probably the reason why the ruling class has been able to dominate the world and dominate so effectively at home. They also are terrified of a vision which I think is a good one, which is the 2050 vision. So a lot of their stuff that's like, take back America, what are they talking about? Let's take it back from the so-called communists. But they're really talking about taking back from black people, from Latin Americans, from gay, you know, from the LGBT, people who are more prominent in American society. So it's take back our society from all these people that we don't like. And the thing, 2050 for them has become a kind of focus, because 2050 is the year when it's the American demographic is expected to change. The Latino population is expected to be 3 times larger. The number of foreign born is going to be 1 to every 4 instead of 1 to every 8. So this is just a nightmare vision. So they are doing everything that they can right now, from, you know, building higher fences to stop this from happening. I think we have to look forward to a much more multiracial United States, where whites are actually a minority of the population. I think that this will be an exciting thing. So, I mean, so the Tea Party has really been egged on and emboldened by the plundocrats, and Obama backed down. Obama, instead of fighting against right-wing criticisms of the proposals, backed down and pandered to them, and that just encouraged them. They have the same idea I would have, which is, if you give us an inch, we'll take a mile. I think that has been their essential strategy. But I think what I'm trying to argue is that they don't represent a majority of American opinion. And lots of studies, again, have shown that a majority of Americans actually disagree with what the Tea Party stands for. And what the Tea Party stands for can be very kind of like unclear. I mean, we're against taxes. Well, yeah, so am I. I'm against taxes that are used to bomb other countries and to give corporate welfare to lots of, to hand out tax cuts for big corporations. A new poll, I think, actually speaks a lot about where the American population is. And I think if you add that to the resistance in Wisconsin, you have a better sense of what the majority thinks in the United States, which is the poll that just came out about attitudes to the free market, where they've said that free market support in the United States was at 80% in 2002, and it's now down to 59%, that the free market is the best way to organize your society. So now China and Brazil actually have higher numbers of people who think that the free market works, which is, you know, I think telling in terms of the way the world economy is beginning to kind of change. But I also think that that tells you a lot about what's actually been changing in the United States. The Tea Party is the party of the free market and whatever kind of bizarre way that they think that that's going to actually move. So the Tea Party has really acted on behalf of big business in the United States, railing against regulation of the free market, railing against any kind of regulation of big business. So it's been funded by big business, and it's unconsciously, they hate Wall Street, but they act in Wall Street's interests. So that has been the role of the Tea Party movement. It's not what the majority of people actually support. So I think Wisconsin, to come back, this is real. This has answered the question. I mean, I think for us, of what the working class movement in Wisconsin or in the United States actually think. So the polls haven't changed. I mean, the polls before Obama got elected that said a majority of people want higher taxes on the rich, a majority of people want redistribution of wealth, a majority of people are sympathetic to more rights for LGBT couples in the United States. All those polls, a majority of people in the United States want to have a union in their workplace, 53%. None of those polls have changed. A majority of Americans still support abortion rights, even if it's called the right, you know, right to choose. That none of those polls have actually changed. So if that's just another indication that the Tea Party doesn't actually represent the vast majority of Americans. But that opinion often gets buried, because the outlets that regular people have are the Democratic Party and the Labour leadership. And unfortunately, when Obama's not fighting on our behalf, Labour leaders are unwilling to challenge Obama for all the sellouts. And then you have 30 years of one-sided class war means that the networks of resistance have been weakened, that people aren't super confident even when they know that they're right, that they don't feel they have the power yet to do something. So all of that has made it harder for, what the majority of Americans actually think. But Wisconsin has broke through that because it's actually said, you know, we're for what reining Wall Street in, we're for union rights, we're actually for all workers to have rights all across the country. And we're ready to struggle and fight when there's actually, an opportunity. So the Republicans and Scott Walker and his ilk have got recognized for union busting and budget busting all across the country. And that's probably what's making the international news as well. And that's been celebrated by in some quarters. But it's not just the Republicans. And this is the dynamic of American politics, where both parties take turns at attacking the American working class. It was Obama. The first thing Obama did in 2011 was he imposed a wage freeze on federal workers so that he could just show the Capitol, I'm now in your camp. I need your funding for my next election campaign, and we agree I'm not going to try any more, I'm not going to have too many more liberal initiatives. Democrats in places like Illinois, California have led the attack, huge cuts to budgets that's going to be devastating for working class people, and huge concessions being demanded of unions in all the big states where the Democrats actually dominate. So this is a bipartisan attack, and both parties in the United States agree that American capitalism needs to become much more competitive, that they are trying to entice some American capitalists that have money stored in other countries to reinvest that in the US. And what American corporations are saying is that the market doesn't look too good in the US. You've got 9%. There's a lack of demand. Why would we invest right now? And Obama is essentially begging capital to come back and reinvest. Now, that's got to do with like an immediate thing about getting unemployment numbers down to win the next election. But it's also got to do with where American capitalism needs to go in the long term if it's going to survive as a dominant or attempted dominant player in world politics. So they want more deregulation, which is the opposite of the American population. They want weaker unions, symbolic unions, and that's the direction that the American ruling class is eager to take. I think that what Wisconsin again shows is that we have the resistance is going to be absolutely crucial to pushing back. Resistance is possible. Wisconsin has shown that. I think it's absolutely inevitable. I think, again, Wisconsin was the last place we expected to erupt when, there's the same social crisis. It's even deeper in other cities. You think about unemployment levels, at depression levels for African Americans and what Latinos are facing. So there's a deep social crisis that actually lays the basis and creates the conditions for, much more resistance. There's also latent new movements in the United States, which are very exciting as well. There's a new women's rights movement that is just, it's beginning to take shape. And it's been protesting against cuts to funding for Planned Parenthood. But one thing that's taken off is something that happened in Canada recently. I don't know if people heard about this, but a police officer said that a young woman deserved to get raped because of what she was wearing, that she was a slut. So what they did in Toronto was that they had a 3,000-person march, and it was called a slut march or slut walk. But this is now taken off. I mean, it's not the name we would give, but it's now taken off across the United States. And I think that is the beginning of people saying we want to be treated with full rights. We don't want to be sexual objects, and we're going to resist this. And if that helps to bring in and create a new women's rights movement, we desperately need that. But it's the same across the board, movements against racism that are small, movements against eviction. I can go through some more of the movements in the discussion, but there's the ingredients for new movements. It's not just the labor movements. It's all sorts of different social struggles. But we know that the ruling class in the United States is strong. This is the, most arrogant, violent ruling class on the planet, and they are going to keep pushing. So the resistance is possible, but politics is going to be important to the resistance. We just seen in Wisconsin, the strategy of the labor movement is to redirect all that anger, energy, desire to struggle into an election campaign for the Democrats. They're hoping that, Wisconsin will lead Obama to win the next election, even though he's done absolutely nothing to deserve that. we have great glimpses, and I talked about a few of them, of like the potential power of the American working class from 2006 and those massive immigrant rights marches to the 2008 occupation of the Republican Doors plant by 200 mostly immigrant workers, many of them documented, who had actually marched on May Day and said that's why they were marching, that this was a continuation of the struggle, the fight for legalization and union rights and the right to work. The 200,000 LGBT march that happened right after Obama's election, and now Wisconsin. I think those are just the highlights, but I think that that is the potential subterranean fire breaking through all across the US. Now, revolutionary socialists are still small in the United States, but I think we can play a really, really vital role. I think we've got two urgent tasks. The first one is we want to engage everybody who says that they're fed up with the free market, that they're opposed to capitalism and they're opposed to the priorities of capitalism. We want to find political spaces for people who are on campuses, in workplaces, in unions, in communities, in neighborhoods, to be, and in the movements, they actually talk about the revolutions in the Middle East, why they're so inspiring. And we want to win those people to be opposition to capitalism and to join in a revolutionary socialist organization. That has to be an urgent task right now, and we have set ourselves out to do that. The second thing is we want to involve ourselves in every struggle that we can be part of. The labour movement, the rebuilding of rank and file organisation in our unions, the anti-racist movement, the anti-eviction struggle, the ecology struggle. We have to be part of all those struggles. The more successfully we grow and the more able we're able to influence and be part of and implant ourselves in struggles, the more effective, the better hope there is for those struggles that break out, and we know they're going to break out. It's just a matter of time. A bigger socialist organization can make sure that those struggles meet their full potential, and we can turn the tide on the class attack in the United States and actually join a global struggle for a much better world. Thanks.